I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. If you've spent time playing along the Jersey Shore this summer, it might be hard to believe that portions of the world's oceans are literally covered in trash. Much of it is plastic, some of it barely big enough to see with the human eye, but nonetheless dangerous to marine and human life. Our guest for the first part of the show is Captain Charles Moore, founder of the Algalita Marine Research and Education Institute. He spent a great deal of time conducting research at the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and is author of a number of scientific papers on plastic particulate pollution. Charles Moore, nice to have you back on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So describe the Great Pacific Garbage Patch for us.
Well, that would be like describing the United States, because it's at least the size of the continental United States, and perhaps twice that if you consider both the eastern and western garbage patches. And it's quite varied, but it has the characteristic of scouring the Pacific Rim on both the Asian and North American coasts and bringing that debris, whatever makes its way to the ocean, into a central convergence zone. So those major currents that make this gyre, this area that circulates, have within them many subcurrents, little eddies and vortexes, and so it's a quite varied environment, as well as being, in general, an accumulation zone. And what the descriptor, I think, would do for the eastern garbage patch that I just visited would be that if you imagined taking your rubbish bin and emptying it into a swimming pool, that's the kind of debris quantities we encountered. It's much worse now than it was when I first saw it. In 1997.
I think most of us think that our trash is going to a landfill. Where is this coming from?
Published figures have 80% coming from land-based sources, but as you get into these garbage patches, they're thousands of miles from land, some of them, and you get more fishing gear. Fishing gear is designed to last in the marine environment, and It floats a lot of it and makes its way into this garbage patch. So you've got the responsibility from some sea-based industries and also from the average consumer on land.
So if it's coming from the average consumer, what are you seeing? Are you seeing sneakers? Are you
toothbrushes? I collect toothbrushes. You have to kind of decide what you're going to collect because there's a lot of different things out there. And My things that I focus on that seem rather unique and interesting to folks when I travel is the umbrella handles, the toothbrushes, the popsicle sticks, and the combs and brushes.
So what, again, is the path, I mean, umbrella handles and combs and brushes that, you know, most of us would hopefully throw in the trash, but is it litter that is somehow getting into coastal waterways and then getting out into the ocean? Is that how, that what the path is?
Are you happy with a yes answer?
I'm not sure if I'm happy any which way you slice it. But thinking about this story, is that the primary way that this stuff is getting into the ocean?
Yeah, the ocean is downhill from virtually everywhere. And, rivers run to the sea. Things blow into the sea. Beachgoers leave things that then wash into the sea. There is a large boating community that may consist of commercial and recreational boaters, and they offer up a certain portion of the debris.
Okay. Take us back to 1997. You were returning to Southern California after a sailing race. Is this when you first, when anybody first came into one of these garbage patches?
No, it's not the first time anybody crossed these garbage patches. They're not frequently crossed. They're not hubs of world commerce. If you look at shipping lanes, and there's some interesting maps, like they have, you know, those of the airplanes and where they travel, and you can see all the lines converging in different places. If you look at shipping maps of the same kind, these gyres, these garbage patches, don't have these convergence of lines where a lot of ships are going through them, so it's not a heavily trafficked area.
Okay, and what were your first thoughts upon first seeing this sort of thing?
Well, the larger ships wouldn't have been able to see it. It wasn't that big. It wasn't that much. You know, if you're standing on the deck of a freighter, and, you know, for instance, car carriers coming from Korea to Los Angeles area might cross this area, you wouldn't have noticed anything in 1997. As a matter of fact, it took me a while standing on deck to see an object, maybe 5 or 10 minutes even, you know, just to see a bottle cap floating by. That was in 1997. Now, this last trip, and 15 years later, the quantity had so increased that you couldn't even count it going past the vessel. 5 years ago, we could stand with a clicker on the bow and get about 10 pieces per minute. But now we're looking at uncountable amounts. People would ask me, "Well, is it like when I first discovered this?" Well, did you feel like you were an icebreaker, sort of going through, you know, pushing plastic out of the way? I said, "Oh, no, nothing like that. Just a piece here and a piece there." But this year, it was like that. It was like we were pushing the stuff out of the way, and this is for hundreds and hundreds of miles. We're not talking about just a dot in the ocean. A lot of people get the impression, well, this is just a big lake kind of phenomenon. We'll clean it up just like we would if it was a large lake. But no, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of miles of debris in such quantities that I could only trawl my net, which I could trawl for several hours in 1999 when we went back and surveyed it scientifically. That same route that we traveled, now I can only trawl for a half an hour without filling up the net. So it's really increased a lot over the decade and a half since I've been looking at it.
And your most recent visit was to the Eastern Garbage Patch?
Yeah, there's if you kind of think of a pumpkin face with the mouth cut out being the gyre, and then the eye on either side widely spaced being the two garbage patches, the western one off Japan and the eastern one halfway between San Francisco and Hawaii. That's the kind of gives you a feeling of what you're looking at. You're looking at, we've been two-thirds of the way to Japan, and then my colleagues have sampled from Japan to the international dateline and passed. So we have a pretty good handle on the quantities of debris all the way from Japan to the coast of North America, and there's plastic debris all the way. I mean, every trawl brings up plastic trash. But then the western garbage patch is a kind of a sub-eddy within the larger phenomenon, and the eastern garbage patch also. And the eastern garbage patch has received the most study from us, and it has definitely grown, not so much in the size of the gyre. These currents are natural forces that don't really grow. They move, but they're fairly stable systems created by fairly stable high pressure atmospheric conditions that prevail over them. So they're going to be fairly stable, but the amount of debris within those fairly stable accumulation zones is definitely on the increase.
And some of this debris is hard to see with the human eye. It's made up of plastic particulates. Can you get into that for us?
Yeah, we trawl a net which is a third of a millimeter in diameter, and we've pretty much got a handle now on the relative proportion of the different sizes that are out there. And the largest size class was the one that increased the most recently. But the most common size class, the larger one being greater than 5 millimeters, but the 1 to 2 millimeter size class is the most common size class. But we see particles in our microscopes down below the millimeter size class. I mean, one of our scientists was filtering seawater with a 0.7 micron. That's 0.7 of a millionth of a meter filter. So we're looking at these polymers. they're very long molecules, and even a broken polymer molecule is still not biodegradable necessarily in any really fast period of time. So you're likely to find, and this is one of the questions we wanted to answer, are there mixed into this water broken polymer chains that are kind of becoming part of this marine environment?
So if I understand you correctly, you've got plastic that has degraded to this tiny particulate, and it can't degrade any further.
Well, no. The process is a long one, however. The further degradation needs to get around 500 molecular weight before bacteria have evolved to be able to consume that size of a molecule.
Okay.
So these larger molecules, which, you know, you can have a molecular weight of over 10,000 in a plastic polymer, that has to be broken apart through chain scission. The polymer chains have to be split through natural forces, and what we've come to understand is those natural forces work very slowly when it comes to splitting these polymer chains. They're very resistant to bacterial decay.
Well, Charles, what is the effect on these polymers on marine life?
Well, there's a multitude of effects, none of them really positive. Some people have said, well, since algae grows on them and barnacles grow on them, they're actually increasing the life in the ocean. But frankly, what they're doing is increasing biomass at the cost of biodiversity. You get these monocultures of barnacles and mosses growing on these bits of plastic, and they're consuming what little planktonic life is out there that would be feeding this very delicate food web that exists out there. I'm wanting to change the name of the garbage patch to King Neptune's Desert Nursery, because these are deserts out in the ocean, and they're nurseries for little things like baby sea turtles. They won't be, a baby sea turtle does not hang, you know, you see them waddling down the beach. They don't stay near the beach. That's the wall of death, that going past that reef. They get away from there as fast as they can before they've been predated, and they go to where there's very little predator activity, which is in these deserts in the ocean, these which have turned out now to be garbage patches, these so-called subtropical gyres. And there they eat these very delicate creatures. It's so calm out there that nature has created a plethora of absolutely delicate
and
just thread-like creatures that are so numerous that these babies of the deep can grow up eating those things.
Charles Moore, we're up against a break. I'd like to pick up on that thread in a moment. But, okay, we're talking about ocean health, plastics pollution with Captain Charles Moore. If you'd like to join the conversation, feel free to give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. More coming right up.
Supporting WHYY, Bryn Mawr College invites artists, journalists, scholars, and experts to the campus to explore the reasons behind and the realities of dissent, violence, and justice. The series kicks off October 1st with a lecture by Mona El-Tahawi, an award-winning columnist and international public speaker on Arab and Muslim issues based in New York. Her talk, titled Revolution, One Ism at a Time, The Global Fight Versus Sexism, Racism, and Other Isms, begins at 7 p.m. at Thomas Great Hall at Bryn Mawr College. No ticket required and open to the public.
A listener stumbles onto a beautiful and colorful plant in the woods and wonders afterwards exactly what he saw. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal what we learned about the wild American strawberry. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturdays at 7 a.m. and again at noon, right here on WHYY-FM.
The Executive MBA at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY and is proud to announce the Executive MBA's relocation to the Hub Commerce Square at 20th and Market Streets in Center City, Philadelphia. In only one weekend per month for 16 months, the Executive MBA is designed to help you expand your leadership and business skills needed to succeed in a complex global economy. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/EMBA.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Enormous amounts of trash have ended up in the world's oceans, in particular plastics. And we're talking about this hour with Captain Charles Moore, who is founder of the Algalita Marine Research and Education Institute. If you have questions, if you have comments, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email if you like at radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet works as well at WHYY Radio Times. So Charles, we're talking about these huge garbage patches. Why don't they get the attention of say global warming?
Well, there are some aspects of it that do play into climate change, and they should. They should be studied in their own right. It's just that they're so remote and outside the exclusive economic zones of any country, and don't have a lot of marine resources, that there's not a lot of energy able to be focused on it. It would require an international effort, and it's just not a crisis, not likely to be a crisis for any nation that they're going to have to address. But they really should, because I spent the last week looking through a microscope at plankton from this area that we captured down about 10 meters deep. And that plankton is being suspended in the water column by fibers of plastic. The marine snow that sequesters carbon dioxide on a large scale is being retarded in its descent to the bottom by bits of plastic that are like life jackets for the marine snow. And I've been pulling plastic out of these blobs of dead planktonic organisms that should be floating to the bottom of the ocean, are hanging around about 10 meters below the surface.
So Charles, what is, if you could, characterize the domino effect here. How does this then go up the food chain in affecting marine life?
Well, you've got concerns, of course, about our seafood that we consume, because plastics accumulate pollutants that affect us humans. The what we call the endocrine disruptors, the gender benders that exist in our pesticides and some of our industrial chemicals like PCBs. These gender benders glom onto the plastic. They've been shown to accumulate them up to 1 million times their level in the surrounding seawater. So they're like sponges going around collecting this bad stuff. Then they're posing as food. They're mimicking natural food. We found 35% of the main fish out there to have consumed plastic. And that's a concern, because then those contaminants desorb from the plastic into the animal, and then that animal, when it's consumed, gives its pollutant load to the consumer, for instance, a salmon or a swordfish or a tuna. And then we catch those fish, and their pollutants transfer to us, and our body burden of synthetic chemicals is rising. So we attribute a lot of the issues of modern society that have sprung up, the epidemic of diabetes, obesity, low thyroid hormone. A lot of these have to do with chemicals associated with plastics, like the flame retardants, for instance, that have been found high in marine mammals. They're also being found in humans.
This does sound, then, as if it should be a cause for considerable international concern, no?
If it was where we caught the tuna, you know, but that's not where we go to catch the tuna. That's not where we go to catch the dolphin fish, the mahi-mahi. We catch them outside these garbage patches. So they're, right now, they're not seen. There are fisheries there. There are some longline fisheries, and we should be concerned about it. We found an albacore that had plastic inside of it from consuming a bait fish, and we should be concerned about it. But frankly, as I said, this issue has not got the cachet of climate change, although I think really in terms of the number of animals killed, because it doesn't just poison these animals and send them up to us as food. It traps them. It entangles them. Millions of fish, birds, marine mammals are killed every year just getting stuck in this stuff. We're starting to see pictures from all over the world of animals stuck and dying, horrible deaths, stuck in the netting and the packing bands. I found a floral wreath of packing bands out there. Someone had taken all the packing bands off all the pallets on a ship or somewhere and made them into a giant wreath and thrown them in the ocean. And by the time we got it, the stuff was so degraded, so cracking and falling apart that just lifting it on the boat completely littered the deck with little fragments of packing bands. So
we're, awful.
These particulates that we talked about earlier are not only produced by photo degradation, the UV rays of the sun cross-linking the plastics and making them crack. They're also produced by sampling. Everything in the ocean is potential food, and every piece of plastic we find of any size is showing evidence of being bitten around the edges. So these particles are being created just by the creatures in the ocean biting little chips off for food.
Charles, the phones are lighting up here, so I'd like to get to some calls. Truong in Fairless Hills, Pennsylvania, welcome to Radio Times. Hi, Truong.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to know what kind of solutions are being looked at as far as either like going around scooping it up or concerning plastic has like a life of like several hundred years or something like that. Is there any type of research that's going into degrading it faster?
Good question.
Thank you.
Charles?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of issues there. One is the degrading faster issue. That envisions some sort of organism that would be better at eating plastic than other organisms found typically in nature, and that's going to somehow be introduced into the marine environment and consume this plastic. That's not a realistic solution. The ocean is way too varied. It's too much to disperse anything in such a way that it would have any way to concentrate itself on these bits of plastic. That's just not an option. I mean, people are working on the biodegradation of plastics, and there are plastics that are being developed that will degrade in the marine environment with the organisms that exist out there. So a better route than looking at an organism to degrade it faster is to look at creating plastics that will degrade faster in the marine environment on their own.
And the garbage patches are too vast to actually have, you know, concerted cleanup of larger debris.
Yeah, well, there's Boyan Slat from the Netherlands that envisions a passive system where he anchors all these capture devices to the bottom and allows the current itself to bump into the capture device and then somehow bring this material to a central location where it's processed. But that affects all the life on the ocean. The ocean in many parts is covered with jellyfish sailing around called Velella Velella, these by-the-wind sailors that are colonial and have very delicate tentacles, and they would be damaged by any kind of a device that's left out there. And it's just a logistical nightmare to try to deploy some kind of a device like that. I do think, however, that industries responsible for creating this plastic plague need to pony up some money and get some research going into these accumulation zones. They're filling up with their crap, and they're doing absolutely nothing. I haven't spent dime one to go to these places, pick up this stuff, and identify where it comes from and find who the dirty dozen are, the worst polluters, and rein them in. You know,
that's how
you attack pollution.
One more follow-up before we get back to the phones. Who and how do you motivate them?
Well, you've got to have a pre-cycling premium on the products that are created so that there's some money in a fund. We do this with oil spills. If this was liquid petroleum, you know, plastic is a solid form of petroleum, but if it was the liquid form, there's international consortiums out there ready to clean up any kind of a spill. It's just that people don't recognize that plastic is actually a worse, more persistent pollutant than petroleum in the liquid form. It's a solid phase of petroleum that persists in the marine environment, collects all the pollutants, transfers them up the food web. It's not biodegradable like petroleum, not in anywhere near the same time scale, and really should be afforded a greater risk to humanity in the public perception than spilled oil. But that ugly crude, which of course merits cleanup and concerted effort, gets all the attention. So we're sort of pushing to get plastic elevated at least to the level of oil in terms of international response to this growing crisis.
All right, and continuing with our calls, Mary Beth, welcome to Radio Times. Mary Beth from New Jersey. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering what's being done to mobilize people to clean this area up, what kind of efforts are being taken to increase awareness, increase an idea of maybe eco-volunteerism, something to most people don't know about this, and I don't want it to just be something that people say, it's too much, it's too big, we can't fix it, because we have to fix it.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Mary Beth. Charles?
Well, I agree. I feel the same sort of frustration myself. Something has to be done, and it's not being done. So we're at the stage of raising awareness. It's like if you'd have walked into a doctor's office with cancer in 1962, and he would not, one of the first questions would have been, if you had throat cancer, well, do you smoke? You know, that required decades of awareness building that there was a connection between smoking and lung cancer. Now we're in the decades-long process of building awareness that the garbage patches are a big problem, that they need to be studied in their own right, that they're unique oceanic features. They're King Neptune's desert nurseries that are very unique in the kind of fauna and that live there, and they deserve to have protection and be protected just as much as a coral reef or, you know, a wetland.
Well, Charles, I'm sorry for interrupting, but if somebody like Mary Beth wanted to take a solid first step, would you advise, say, talking to her congressional legislator or representative?
I don't think so. I don't think there's any kind of traction in the legislative arena. Frankly, I've been reduced to localism, you know, pushing for packaging is 50% of the problem. And if you buy locally, you can eliminate a lot of packaging. You can take your bag to the farmer's market. You can take your cup to Starbucks. You can take your own doggy bag to the restaurant. You can refuse a straw when you're given a glass of water. There's things you can do to kind of eliminate plastic in your own life because, yes, legislators are working on the problem in California by passing a plastic bag ban. We need to ban styrofoam as a food delivery material. It's an inappropriate material for delivery of food, these clamshells and these white styrofoam cups. We just don't need them. It's the wrong stuff.
All right, back to the phones. Chris in New Jersey, you're live on Radio Times. Hi, Chris.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yes, I'm just wondering if it would be economical and possibly even profitable to harvest for recycling, since money talks, if there's a feasible way to encourage potentially the people that are causing the pollution and are producing these products that could use the same raw material again to recycle.
Charles, is plastic tough to recycle?
Yeah, plastic's a nightmare to recycle. It's very difficult to clean it. It's very difficult to separate it into the separate types. Where you get most of the action in recycled plastics is from the sweepings on the floor of the factory. That's called production scrap. Production scrap, you know where it's coming from. It's fairly clean. It hasn't left the factory. It's just the spoo holes and stuff they've drilled out of the plastic and stuff they've shaved off. There's a market for that stuff. China won't take dirty plastic bottles. There's 10,000 containers waiting on the docks in Hong Kong that mainland China won't take into process because it's too dirty. They have a new green fence policy, and they're not going to be the dumping ground of unrecyclable plastics. They're going to resist that. The making a profit off of dirty, used plastic is not truly possible. What you got to do is get it before it's dirty and reaches the environment. Once it's reached the environment, yes, there's a couple of companies, Method Home Cleaning Products makes a soap bottle out of plastic. They get off the beach in Hawaii, high-density polyethylene. They sort that, make a gray bottle. It's going to be gray in color because all the plastics mixed together are kind of gray and black. But that's a very tiny drop in the bucket, and they spend money to do that. That's not a big profit maker.
And we have time to squeeze in one more call here. Ron from Philadelphia, you're on Radio Times. Ron, you there?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Sure.
The question I had was, a couple of years ago, New York City put over 300 tons of trash on a ship. And every once in a while, it hit the news that it was still out there. They were sailing from port to port. Nobody wanted the trash.
Yep.
Is anybody actually looking at the trash haulers?
Charles?
Well, could you rephrase that question for me? It was a little scratchy on my end.
He was telling the story, and this is a big story a number of years ago, that there was a ship carrying trash and nobody would take it. It could not dock. It could not unload its load. And he's wondering, does anybody monitor trash hauling ships?
You have a manifest aboard ship that you should present to the authorities in the harbor you come in. Which declares how much plastic you've taken on in terms of packaging and how much then should be offloaded to correspond to how much you've taken on. So in countries that obey the MARPOL Treaty and MARPOL Annex 5, which prohibits the dumping of plastic at sea from ships, there are methods for looking at the manifest of that ship to see what has come in that was put on board that should then be offloaded. And I know when I docked in Japan, there were several different trash trucks that came, one for paper, one for plastic, one for metal, you know. There's many ports are quite sophisticated, but the lion's share of ports around the world don't have this infrastructure. And so you won't be getting signatories to MARPOL countries doing that kind of inventory.
Charles, who on the world stage is receptive to better management of plastics waste, and who is not?
Well, I think everyone is receptive to the concept. We're leaving the age of extraction and entering the age of reuse. We've got to elevate those people who reuse products to a higher level of prestige. The recycling industry is considered a dirty, grubby industry, and you know, it really needs to be given the kind of respect it deserves, because that's how we're going to be getting our materials in the future. You'll be seeing more and more of this mining of landfills to get the resources out of there as the extraction of virgin material becomes more expensive. So that's one way to look at it.
Charles Moore, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
You're quite welcome.
Charles Moore is founder of the Algalita Marine Research and Education Institute. Coming up, we take a close look at the unique and beautiful Sargasso Sea, which is threatened by, among other things, plastics pollution and climate change. We'll talk to David Freestone, Executive Secretary of the Sargasso Sea Commission. And as always, if you'd like to join the conversation, it's as easy as calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. More coming right up.
PNC Arts Alive and Opera Philadelphia support WHYY and present Opera on the Mall, The Barber of Seville, Saturday, September 27th, an HD broadcast at Independence Mall, open to the public. Tickets at operaonthemall.org.
Guided by Quaker values, Folkways at Gwinnett, a continuing care retirement community for active adults 65 and over since 1967, supports WHYY. Folkways provides residents with proven financial stability, a comprehensive health care program, and a community where friendship, caring, dignity, and respect are a way of life. One- and two-bedroom apartments, highlighting Folkways' newest design features, are now available. To experience life at Folkways and to arrange a personal tour, 215-283-7010.
Ebola days in harm's way in Liberia.
Even basic things like intravenous fluids end up helping patients pull through and support them while their body fights off the virus.
On the clinical front lines and the logistical front lines of the battle to stop Ebola in West Africa. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first ever Lincoln MKC with the all-new available 2.3-liter EcoBoost powertrain for the power and poise to handle any driving situation. More available at Lincoln.com.
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain, and this is Radio Times. The Sargasso Sea is the only sea in our world without land to define its boundaries. Located in the Atlantic Ocean near Bermuda, it is a unique marine ecosystem which is threatened by shipping, climate change, and ocean acidification, among other things. Joining us to tell us more about the Sargasso Sea and efforts to protect it is David Freestone, Executive Secretary of the Sargasso Sea Commission. He is also adjunct professor and visiting scholar in law at George Washington University's Law School. David Freestone, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary. Great pleasure to be with you.
So describe the unique characteristics of the Sargasso Sea for us.
Well, Charles, it's great to come on after Charles Moore because he's already done a lot of the heavy lifting on this, because the Sargasso Sea basically is a gyre, like the garbage patches that we heard from the back in the Pacific. The North Atlantic subtropical gyre around Bermuda is actually an area of ocean which is moving in a clockwise direction, which kind of holds and gathers in material into the center of it. And just as in the Pacific, there's plastic there, there's also plastics in the North Atlantic as well. Not quite, we think, the amounts that we've seen in the Pacific, but still large amounts. But the positive side of this is that it also collects sargassum seaweed, which is a floating weed which reproduces without contact with the shore, as you said. So it self-perpetuates, it breaks up, and life continues sort of within the gyre itself. So rather than being a desert, which is the way that Captain Moore described the Pacific, this is actually, somebody's described this, is actually famous marine biologist Sylvia Earle has described it as the floating rainforest of the ocean, because it's actually very rich in biodiversity. We heard about some of the species like the sea turtles, which get off the beach as quick as they can, and they find themselves in the Atlantic, in the amongst the sargassum, which hides them, and they can actually eat it as well. So it's actually a major nursery for sea turtles, but also for a large numbers of other fish as well. Hmm. So rather than being a desert, it's actually quite an important marine ecosystem, and it's huge. I mean, we've identified a core area which we're defining as our sort of study area, which is 2 million square miles.
Wow. So let's just get back to the fact that you said it's a gyre, and you alluded to what we were talking about with Charles Moore. Is there a large garbage patch issue there or not?
Oh, there is, yes. A number of organizations have actually been sampling and looking at it. It's not got the publicity of the Pacific one, and I think because of issues like the Japanese tsunami, which put a lot of garbage into the Pacific, it's not quite so understanding. It's not quite so developed. There's a lot of plastic waste. Most of it, as Charles says, is land based. So plastic bags and plastic materials, which then are breaking down. The Sea Education Association in Woods Hole does a cruise through the Sargasso Sea every year, and it's been monitoring, and there's been a major increase in the amount of plastics that they're picking up. And we're not talking about necessarily bottles and things like that, although they are there, but it's this microplastics. It breaks down, it photos, it's not biodegradable, it's photodegradable, but only breaks down to small amounts, small pieces, which the fish eat and the turtles eat, etc. So similar sort of impacts.
So, and what are you seeing in terms of the impact on the unique sea life in the Sargasso Sea?
Well, it's one of the risks. I mean, it's a very productive area. It's an area which is productive in terms of photosynthesis. So there are the picoplanktons, which were discovered there 20 years ago, are actually major sources of carbon sequestration. So it's, and of course, the living weed itself is actually sequestering carbon. So it's a major sort of positive ecosystem for in terms of climate change. But the Bermudians, the Bermuda Institute for Ocean Sciences, has been monitoring this for like 50 years, and they've noticed quite distinct warming of the ocean temperatures. They've noticed increased acidification. And as Charles was telling us, you know, the presence of plastic kind of exacerbates these issues, as well as pollution of creatures, of course.
So let's talk about acidification. What does that do to the water, and how does that change the ecosystem?
Well, it's major impact. I mean, acidification basically means that creatures that are calcium-based can't create the increased acidity, actually start to melt them. So coral reefs, it is going to have major impacts on, but also it could impact small plankton, which have, you know, calcium, very small calcium delicates, calcium skeletons, and obviously creatures like crabs and those with exoskeletons, which are calcium-based, are being impacted as well. If it increases, acidification increases to the levels which are being predicted, if the CO2 emissions are not controlled, it would be, you know, it would be catastrophic. About 150 million years ago, there was actually an event which we don't know that much about why, but it increased the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by the sort of amounts which they're currently buried, you know, buried in the earth in terms of coal and oil resources. And the result was basically the elimination of ocean life. And it took about 200,000 years for it to recover slowly. So it's a pretty major threat. It's actually probably, given the disputes there are about some of greenhouse effects, I mean, it actually might be, if we'd started off talking about ocean acidification rather than climate change, we might have actually moved forward with the development of a treaty for this more quickly, maybe.
And I'd like to get into that pact in just a bit. We're talking to David Freestone, Executive Secretary of the Sargasso Sea Commission, about the health of the Sargasso Sea. Phone lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can shoot us an email if you like, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at @whyyradiotimes. And David, I understand that shipping is also a threat to the Sargasso Sea.
Yes, I mean what we're trying to do is to identify what the most obvious impacts are, the human impacts. I mean, we've talked about plastics, we talked about climate change, but also any form of human activity which is going to disrupt the mats, these big mats of sargassum, is obviously affecting the system itself. And I think the first person to describe it was actually Christopher Columbus in his first voyage in 1492, and he actually described the mats as so big that the sailors were worried that they couldn't move their sailboats through them.
Well, what color are they? Is it a brown or gold?
Gold. It's a golden brown, yes. If I say silver, I call it the golden rainforest. They're golden colors, yes. And they're mostly at the surface. It hangs within the first 4 or 5 feet, a couple of meters, and it acts like a fisheries aggregation device. If you float anything in the ocean, fish sit underneath it, for reasons we're not really sure, but I mean, it provides a little ecosystem. So there's a lot of fish aggregation underneath it. A lot of them commercially important species too, like what we call mahi-mahi, the dolphin fish, tunas, wahoo, and a lot of the game fishes, and marlin as well. One of the areas where marlin certainly spawn, and some of the tunas, albacore and others, spawn as well. So it's a very productive system because of this artificial, as it were.
So is the Sargasso Sea then fished internationally?
They're fished around the edges of it. So it's that's one of the problems, really, of this area, which is why we've set up this commission to kind of keep the health and well-being, its health and well-being under review, because there's no international treaty governing the environment of this part of the Atlantic. There's no fisheries treaty which deals with all the fisheries there. The only body which has some responsibility is the International Convention for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas, which is only looking at tunas and tuna-like species. Now, there isn't really any proper regulation of it, but we reckon the catches are fairly small. But the significance of it is really the fact that it acts as a breeding, spawning area for the areas around it. And, of course, the Atlantic is extremely important as a source of tunas and other game fishes for human consumption.
David, before we get to the telephones, I'd like to get back to shipping for just a moment. I'm not sure we entirely painted the picture of what happens when you have, I guess, ships from various countries traveling through the Sargasso Sea.
Right. So the back to Columbus, so he couldn't get his little boats through it because it's a gyre, it's a bit of a doldrum. But once you have mechanically driven vessels, they can just forge through the middle of it. And so we're getting it's obvious, I think, that the big mats have been broken up by shipping. It's one of the busiest shipping routes in the world between Europe and the Americas, not just North America, but down to the Panama Canal and to South America. So it's a very, very busy area. And there aren't actually defined routes. It's pretty random. We had a survey which showed the shipping trails of vessels crossing over a month period, and you know it's a pretty busy area. So these large vessels are breaking up the mats, and that, you know, there's a positive side to that. If you break up a mat, it's going to start to reproduce, but you also drive all the creatures away. So and there's some evidence that the larger predators kind of follow these boats because they know that the fish are going to be disrupted and disturbed by the mats being destroyed. So that's one thing. Discharges, not just of plastics, and because I think that as Charles Moore told us, there's a MARPOL convention which deals with discharges of plastics, but wastewater. Which is not necessarily sewage, but grey water, which actually increases the nutrient content, which kind of changes the composition of it. So those are the sorts of things that we've been looking at. But we're talking about a huge area, and the scientific capability to actually monitor this on a regular basis is extremely difficult.
And I'd like to... I'm sorry for interrupting. Go ahead, finish your thought.
Well, I was just going to say that NASA has actually been... step forward to help us to actually provide the monitoring of the oceanographic conditions and ecological conditions from space. So that's a tremendous assistance and boost to the commission, which is set up really as a result of collaboration between five governments in the first instance: the U.S., the U.K., which is Bermuda's an overseas territory of the U.K., the Bermuda itself, of course, the Azores, and also Monaco, which is a major player in marine conservation. Prince Albert II is one of the great supporters of ocean conservation efforts. So those five governments have sort of sponsored the setting up of this Sargasso Sea Commission, but we hope other governments will join in time as well.
And David, I'd like to get into that international pact a little bit more, but I'd like to also squeeze a telephone call or two in here before we wrap up the show. Joe in New Jersey, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure.
I'd like to ask your guest a question. I know it's really hard to tell where we are with all environmental problems, if we're at the beginning, we're at the middle, we're at the end of the environment. It's hard to tell where we are in the stream of time. But that said, as we look at these things, and I know you're studying this and I appreciate your expertise, what if this problem was 25 times worse than it is right now? So in other words, we can't stop manufacturers, we can't change the political scene, and let's say it continues to worsen where it's 50 times worse than it is right now. What is the end game here? What happens to the sea if this continues?
A doomsday scenario. David Freestone?
It is, yeah. I mean, we shouldn't regard ourselves as being impervious to this. There's no reason why mankind should actually continue to exist on the planet. The geologists are actually suggesting that we're entering a new age called the Anthropocene, which is a new geological age. In other words, we have already made such an impact on the planet that in 2 million years' time, when there probably won't be human geologists, but others are looking and saying, what's going on with this? And they're chipping through the stones. They'll actually find a little line which shows where man's impacts have been. So if we don't get ourselves together, we're in really bad shape. I mean, if we talked about climate change, the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, has warned that if we go above 2 degrees Celsius warming above pre-industrial times, and we're up to about getting up into the first degree of that, that we will actually encounter dangerous climate change. Mm. So dangerous climate change means acidification is a commitment to acidification, which we won't be able to roll back.
David,
not in reasonable time.
Yeah. I wanted to thank Joe for the call. And in the minute we have left, I'd like to talk briefly about the Sargasso Sea Commission. Can it help to police shipping or plastics dumping, that sort of thing?
Well, we have no formal powers. It's purely a stewardship body, but it's part of its mandate is to actually make sure that that these issues reach the a wider public. So that's why I'm delighted to be able to talk to you about it today, because it's the opportunity to people that had asked Charles Moore, why aren't we doing, where have we got to with this? And the issue is we're raising awareness of the importance of this. So that's one of our mandates, is really to bring international attention to the importance of these systems. On land systems like the Serengeti Plains or the Yellowstone Park, we preserve these huge areas because we think they're intrinsically important. And we think the Sargasso Sea is a similar sort of ecosystem. But because it's out of sight of land and large, and the impacts are more difficult to actually perceive in the first instance, it's out of public mind. So our job is to get it into the onto the world stage.
David Freestone, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
David Freestone is Executive Secretary of the Sargasso Sea Commission. And as always, you can find out more about our program, including our Facebook page and podcasts, by visiting whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. Quinn Lipson is our intern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks so much for joining us.